All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome. You are here with Bruce Wells and Lynn Johnson, the house of the risen sun. The sun has risen, and actually, I do see a little bit of light out my window, so that winter solstice thing that we learned about in school really does work. So, but hopefully everyone can hear us. And it does appear that we do have sound. So so there we are. There's Dove. All right. So he did. He's there. Good morning, Dove. Good morning, everyone. And hi, Dean. Good to see you this morning. He left. And Delia, I don't know, Casey James and Nigel and Richard. Good morning to you all. And so, I guess, you know, time for Bruce to say hello while I'll open up my Kindle book and get ready for the reading. So, say hello, Bruce.
Good morning, Lynn and all. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming in loud and clear.
Oh, good, okay. So, yeah, it's still, you know, much more muddled than usual, but I think I can hear you okay, so.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to get a different microphone. I've been having some difficulty with it, and I'm not trying to switch my account. Now I'm getting glad, so okay, here we go. Let's see if this works. As, oh no! Amazon's been, I have been having difficulties. My husband changed the password. Neither of us can remember what it is, and so I may have to, hey, you know what I have right here in my hand here? And actually, I have the actual book now because Gary sent it to me. So I'm
nice.
Book in hand, but we're going to go to electronic because it's going to be easier for me to see. All right, so, and I've been... I'm actually taking, believe it or not, as much as I've protested in the past, the Waking Together ministerial program. I have I have succumbed to that, and so now I will be studying Buddhism in January, which is kind of cool because we're reading this here book about Jesus and Buddha. So I'm getting a different outlook on and what happened with Jesus and Buddha. So yeah, that's not working either. So I also have it on my phone. But you know what, I'm just gonna get the physical book and where did I put it? And we'll just go from there.
Okay. Shall I start reading while you're looking for
your book? Why don't you start reading while I'm looking for my book?
Okay. So for the last few weeks, Lynn and I have been reading from Gary Renard's fourth book, which has been out, I guess, a couple months now, and highly recommended. And we took several weeks reading Gary's author's note, which precedes what we're about to read, which is actually chapter one this morning. And highly recommended. A superb achievement in my mind in terms of this new book. And anyway, this book, which is entitled The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, has just, I think, reopened A Course in Miracles to not only myself, but a lot of people. And I also have links to not only the book where you can get it on Amazon, as well as a recent interview with Gary and Cindy Laura Renard, both on acimblog.com if anybody's interested in that. So anyway, meanwhile, we are now at the point where we can actually start reading the first chapter in Gary's book here, and which is The Ladder to Enlightenment. And it starts with, there are three great mysteries in life. To a bird is the air. To a fish, it is the water. And to a human being, it is himself. And then the byline is a traditional Buddhist saying. That's the quote that opens this chapter. So it begins, there were many questions I wanted to ask my teachers, Artin and Persa, that I hadn't. And for anybody who's just tuning in and or who, particularly those who aren't familiar with Gary's books, Artin and Persa are two ascended masters who appeared to Gary on his couch a number of years ago, and who pop in at times not consciously known by Gary, but when he's by himself, they show up and have provided a tremendous amount of insight. And spoiler alert for those of you who haven't read his books, they're basically the future selves of Gary and his wife Cindy, and have basically come to help us. But we, you know, symbolically, we all have that representation in the form of the Holy Spirit in our lives. We all have essentially what we would think of as our future self prompting us moment by moment by moment. He just happens to have an occasional visit from a visible within the context of the dream manifestation of that awareness to kind of help him and lots of others, including myself, yours truly, and so many others, kind of get back into and accelerate their progress with the pure non-dual metaphysics of A Course in Miracles. So anyway, I'll start that paragraph over. There were many questions I wanted to ask my teachers, Artin and Persa, that I hadn't. Many times when they appeared to me, I'd forget what I wanted to ask them because I was so amazed at their presence, as in, bink, materializing seemingly out of nowhere. Each experience was still surreal to me, even after there had been dozens of them. For example, I wanted to ask, how did Jesus get to be Jesus? What was his previous lifetime like before he was Jesus? And how did Buddha get to be Buddha? What were the experiences they had, and what disciplines had they practiced that enabled them to awaken and attain their enlightenment before other people did? So, that's the perfect preface to the first half of this book. Do you want to continue, Lynn? Are you squared away on?
Not there yet. So keep going.
Oh, okay. I'll read another paragraph. Okay, my teachers had taught me that these past lifetimes were like serial dreams. We never actually incarnate into a body. We never have really been in a body and never will be. So that kind of answers the question of how did Artin and Persa materialize? Well, they never did because we never did. Which is sort of the perfect answer to all those, you know, dozens of questions that come to mind of, you know, what's going on here with Gary? Well, the same question could be asked of us. You know, why do we believe that our so-called physical experiences are real? You know, it's an equivalent question, but one most people don't ask. Okay, I'll start that paragraph over too. My teachers had taught me that these past lifetimes were like serial dreams. We never actually incarnate into a body, which is to say our spiritual being, our true essence, what we really are, never has been or will be in a body. But that's part of the dream, isn't it? That we've made astonishingly real and vivid, but it is a dream. Our experience is a trick of the ego, a sleight of hand, an optical illusion, or as Einstein put it, an optical delusion of consciousness. We believe we are in a body and are seeing the universe with the body's eyes, when the truth is we are actually seeing with the mind. That M word that A Course in Miracles keeps bringing us back to. And I love how Ken Wapnick says, you know, if you're a student of the Course in Miracles and you're actually, you know, serious about, you know, applying it and experiencing the peace that comes from it, you have to keep remembering, coming back to the pure non-dual metaphysics of the Course, which is that it, and any pure non-dual teaching worth its salt, is always and only about the mind. And sometimes we forget that because we keep thinking, well, I'll just apply it to this world, which it keeps telling us is a dream. And there's nothing wrong with attempting to do that, except it just misses the whole point of what the curriculum is to get back to the content of our mind where we believe we shattered perfect oneness. We, you know, threw God under the bus, or however you want to think of it. And that unconscious guilt. See, again, Lynn, I'm sorry, I was talking.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, so I finally had to change my Amazon password, so I'm gonna have to change it everywhere now. But that's okay. So I just wanted to kind of point out something that I was thinking about this morning when I first got up, and of course, you know, this has become very clear to me what it is that Jesus is talking about here in A Course in Miracles about the existence of the body, our experience as a body, and the way that we perceive ourselves as being this limited thing. And I wanted to go back just a minute to the previous paragraph that you had read. Sorry to take you backwards, but the whole idea you were talking about Artin and Persa and the appearance of Jesus in the world and the appearance of, you know, obviously the appearance of any physical form, being in form, mm-hmm. in the world actually appearing in my mind, because it is impossible for this world to exist as it appears. And, you know, there are many, many reasons. And right now I think quantum physics and science is kind of coming up to that same kind of conclusion. But the reality of it is, when Jesus talks about in A Course in Miracles, and he does talk about this, I know there are a lot of people who think that this is all bunk and hogwash, but Jesus talks about this very situation and this very condition wherein someone who has come to realize and to know the reality or lack of reality of the world and the physical self is able to walk through the world without being touched by the world. And so the idea that essence of the being or whatever that is that comprises Gary Renard continue to visit the world of form and act down in the world in form, and just like Jesus and Buddha over and over and over, they can appear before you anytime. Jesus himself, from accounts in the Bible, was able to appear before people, walk on water, completely disobey the laws of the physical world, because those are not actual laws. Those are thoughts in the mind. And once he knew that he was not bound by the physical world because of he was not bound by those thoughts, he is able, he could stand in front of me right now. He could go, you know, he can do anything. So too could Artin and Persa, who are actually Gary and Cindy, in this lifetime, they have not realized that. But in another part of the story, they have. And because they know that, that's how they're able to appear in form in the world. And you know, it may sound a little convoluted, but once you start getting the notion of the truth of the reality of the illusion, you actually see how this is. So, and I've been watching, I don't know if I mentioned it last week, but the television show on HBO called Westworld. Mm-hmm. And if you have watched Westworld, that show is so filled with hints and pointers at the reality of our existence that you're just going to be blown away by it. It's an amazing thing. So, you know, people who read Gary's books either decide to suspend their disbelief about Artin and Persa and agree that to believe that they are actually here, just as you suspend your disbelief about Jesus and believe that he actually did the things he did. And just as
we suspend our disbelief that we think we are actually in bodies, which is what the whole point of this first page, I think, is trying to tell us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's what it is. It is suspending the disbelief that we are something beyond this. Mm-hmm. And then that opens up to be able to actually see the truth about ourselves. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just found my.
Oh, that was a perfect aside, and fits nicely into, you know, what this page is about. So yeah, that's very well said. Yeah, thank you.
So carry on.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I'll finish that second paragraph. We believe we're in a body and are seeing the universe with the body's eyes, when the truth is we're actually seeing with the mind. In turn, everything we see, including our own bodies, is merely part of the same projection as is everything else in the dream universe. And a quote that comes to mind that is one of those definitive statements in A Course in Miracles is, there is no world, this is the central thought the Course attempts to teach, meaning the material universe of space-time, individuality, bodies, certainly the whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear and death that's behind that, those are all dreams. And that's the whole, you know, whole point of this curriculum is to return us to the peace that we truly have never left except in a dream. By recognizing that the dream is not our identity. Okay, and then it concludes, the paragraph concludes with, and they are only that, projections with no substance, much the same as in a movie theater. And I think that's why the theatrical metaphor is just so powerful. And you mentioned Westworld, and I think that whole genre of films, of virtual reality films, is, and there, you know, I have countless examples. I've got dozens and dozens listed on my internet movie database ratings and other places. Another favorite one is Inception. You know, the levels of dreaming, you know, the levels of theatrical misdirection, if you want to call it that, the magician. I mean, so many good metaphors, you know, but the virtual reality genre of films certainly, and television has provided us with, like you say, ample opportunities for getting hints as to this. And we wouldn't be having those had we not been living in this time and have been exposed to things like A Course in Miracles, which was really predicated, as Ken Wapnick points out, on having a number of centuries of traditions of Platonic thinking, as well as Essene and Gnostic traditions, as well as people the likes of Einstein and Freud, and so many others that all Shakespeare, so many other factors that led into not only Helen's cultural influences and interests, but also the whole backdrop of our current world, connectivity that gives us the context that we can apply this and make good use of it, and certainly in our Western culture, and there's certainly a lot of people in other countries and in the Eastern sphere that are recognizing the, shall we say, Buddhist and or other Eastern traditions that integrate so nicely with the course's teachings, because it really does not only say that, you know, the world is an illusion, as a lot of Eastern traditions do, but as Ken Wapnick points out, A Course in Miracles takes it a step further and says that it's purposive, and that the illusion is purposive because it's trying to keep us mindless and trying to keep us from returning to that awareness that nothing ever happened, and that the guilt that is unconscious is also unfounded. And I think that's what we learned through our forgiveness classroom, that really does accelerate our progress back to the peace that we never left on a consistent basis. So anyway, do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. And I just wanted to kind of also mention in that, if you haven't watched it, there are 10 episodes right now, and they're going to start the new ones. I'm not sure when they're going to start the new episodes, but if you haven't watched it, I just urge you to find a way to see this show, because it is amazing. And it's when they ask the characters, because some of these characters are animatronic, but they appear very, very human. There really seems no difference between them and the humans that are there in their world. But when they talk to, like, the character, like the doctor will say, Dolores, do you know where you are? And she says, I'm in a dream. So the characters, the animatronic characters, believe that they are dreaming, and that all of this that's happening to them is in a dream, and they have no memory of the dream when they go from one session to another. They wipe their memories. The people there wipe their memories so that they don't have, you know, they don't carry this stuff with them. But what happens is these characters are becoming sentient, and they are remembering their experiences, and their suffering and their pain is what brings them to this knowing that this is not real. And so it's brilliant. I think, you know, the guy who wrote that, he's the same guy that wrote Interstellar, and there's quite a few other Chris and his I think they're brothers, Nolan. Anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, that would kind of fit, because he's also the one who wrote Inception too. So
yes, Inception.
Christopher Nolan. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's his brother. I think his name Richard.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
Oh, okay.
It's just brilliant. It's just brilliant, and it gives you so many clues. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, what are these people, you know, reading A Course in Miracles, and you know, how do they have these ideas? It's so perfect analogies, and really, I've gotten so many insights from this. Maybe I'm fooling myself, but I think it's amazing. You know, this knowing, and sometimes I'll do that, and I'll just like, I'm in a dream. You know, this is a dream. This is not really happening, and be able to actually see beyond that. That you know, that you know, God would never have made this. So it's pretty cool. All right, I'm going to go on to the next paragraph. In the fall of 2013, I hadn't seen my teachers for about 9 months. I had a feeling they could show up at any time, and my intuition of them appearing had become very accurate. Well, yeah, because it's him. So, you know, there's not much intuition when you're already that person, that being. You just open to the knowing of what is. So this was because I become more in touch with spirit and come to learn that Artin and Persa were the Holy Spirit taking on a form in order to communicate. The Holy Spirit has to take on a form, or else we'd never be able to hear it, and we'd be stuck in illusions forever. The most common way for the Holy Spirit to show up is in the form of ideas that come into our minds. An idea has form to it, and in some cases, the Holy Spirit takes on different forms. It all depends on what is best for the person being communicated to. This is why we shouldn't compare our experiences to those of other people. The Holy Spirit knows what's best for us. And I agree with that completely, because you'd have no idea what another person's experience is. And, you know, I've had many, many people tell me, oh, you know, that you couldn't have possibly experienced that thing or this thing, because they couldn't have. That's not part of their experience. But I've learned, and especially from Gary Renard, that I have no basis on which to judge another person's experience. And I don't know what's going on in their mind. And I believe the Holy Spirit shows up in everything in order to show me the truth about what I am. So I don't disbelieve. You know, I was skeptical. You know, I was skeptical. But, you know, now I just see how perfect it is and how wonderful it is that Gary actually accepted or agreed to have this happen in this particular time place. Because there is a real, I mean, because of how the miracle can collapse time, that if you accept these things as they come, and you allow yourself to be open to see the truth behind it, that the miracle that comes from it, the miracle of actually forgiving the world for what I think it is, and seeing that nothing I think it is true, that actually shifted me to be open for many, many, many experiences that I've had. And I believe a lot of other people have had that same opening. So, you know, but you know, Gary took a lot of flack and still does. A lot of people have negative thoughts about him. And, you know, he's just boldly going and doing what he does unapologetically, because there it is absolutely what we need right now. So anyway, that's my thought about that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the flack, if you want to think of it in these terms, which I tend to, is really just, you know, calls for love, which is basically, you know, to kind of put it in the context, I think might be helpful, that I find helpful, is that when there's resistance to the ideas behind what's being communicated, that can take a lot of different forms. And some people will just, you know, not go anywhere net of anything metaphysical with a 10-foot pole, or you know, a 10 parsec pole, whatever. But at the same time, you know, there's a huge array of ways that we can resist the teachings that we're talking about here. I find one of the most common ways that I have is I can listen to Ken Wapnick's tapes. And sort of do multitasking stuff, because I enjoy, you know, gleaning the insights from those. And I can find that you know, I can be listening to him for, you know, extended periods and realize I haven't heard a word because I've been focused on something else. Or I can be involved in a study group and reading out loud. And I'll read something that I know I read out loud before, you know, in the course. And it's like, wow, how did that get there? I know one part of me says I know I've read this before because I've read through all three volumes and the supplements many times. And another part says, yeah, and now you're ready to accept the meaning behind the words that perhaps you weren't quite as ready to integrate at that level before. So I think we can begin to be extremely tolerant and patient with each other and with ourselves for the resistance that we have, because we don't want the theater lights to come on, you know, all of a sudden, and, you know, the end credits. we're still involved in our little West worlds, or our Inception dramas, or whatever, you know, script seems to be our current fascination with our dream world of space and time. We don't want that to be over. Otherwise, we would have chosen that a long time ago. So we need to be very patient with ourselves as we begin to integrate these ideas more and more fully. And just moment to moment, forgive ourselves for when we either through our projections see that reflected in what appear to be other people having issues with Gary's work or whatever it might be, or our own resistance to whether it's, you know, the kind of stuff we're reading this morning or the course itself or whatever that, you know, brings us back to the mind, because that's the last thing the ego wants to do. And, you know, the enormous resistance that we all have is something that we can afford to be patient with, because the more we don't condemn And blame and belittle ourselves and, you know, go into that ego downward spiral, you know, the more we can avoid doing that, the more we actually make progress in overcoming the resistance. Because if we can look at the resistance without condemnation, the part of us that's looking without condemnation really is the Holy Spirit. And that's what the whole point is to begin to identify with that awareness and gently return the helm, so to speak, to the control of our mind to that awareness, so that we steer our ship out of the stormy waters of the ego's dream and back to the safe harbor that is really where the Holy Spirit is guiding us all the time. So any comments on that before I read the next paragraph?
I do one comment. I have been listening to a lot of Ken lately. And something I heard him say yesterday really was exactly what you're saying. He says, you know, you read the course and you can't remember what you read.
Uh-huh.
You read it and you can't remember it. And he says, you didn't forget what you ate for breakfast this morning. You didn't forget how you got from here to there. You didn't forget, you know, you didn't forget anything else, but you forget what you just read. That should be a clue.
Exactly.
To your existence. That, you know, you are purposely not seeing what's there. And, you know, again, the same thing, these characters in Westworld, there's certain things that they cannot see. You could show them a photograph of themselves or some other thing, and they'll look and say, that doesn't look like anything to me. And that is, it's the ego resistance.
Right.
And it says, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't make sense. I don't understand it. So, and in fact, a lot of people, when they're talking about the Course and they're talking about Jesus's description of what kind of experience we could be having, and the experience of no self, the experience of not a body, the experience of spirit, and they say, or the experience of no world. You mentioned that from lesson 132. There is no world. That's a central premise on which this course is written. And they'll say, well, I don't believe that. I believe the course. I believe what Jesus is saying, but I think he's lying about that part, because I'm not experiencing it. And so they resist even the thought that they could experience it, because they see that once they experience there is no world, just as these characters that are dreaming, that once they realize they're dreaming, they wake up. And and so that's, you know, it really is that very thing. It's resistance to the truth, and believing that it is somehow or the other we're being fooled. And I do a lot of people who will argue like crazy over that. You know, well, yeah, I know it says there is no world, but that's not my experience. This is a table, you know. And, you know, you got to laugh. Because it's only a table, because it's in your mind as a table.
and as an infant, it's just a whole bunch of photons that you haven't learned to identify as a table, you know. And even that, you know, you have to train the eyes to focus, and you have to train the whole perceptual mechanism to really suspend the disbelief in the movie. But we forget that we did that so skillfully, and we've made up such an elaborate system with the optical equipment in our eyes and the retinas and the brains and the lengths that we went to make this dream appear real are just staggering. And yet our real nature is outside of space and time, just laughing gently, not in any kind of derisive way, at the whole notion that, you know, we could have done this. But it's a testament to the power of the mind that we were able to do this, and we were able to make a delusional thought system that seems so authentic and so real. But our resistance to undoing that is enormous. And so even if we don't verbally go la, 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 la when someone says something that you know they don't want to hear, mentally we do that as well. And you mentioned that great comment, which I think I just heard something, either that one or something very similar in one of Ken's audios recently. And another one he shares that I think ties into it as far as the resistance is, you know, a lot of times, you know, not, in addition to not only just forgetting what you just read, but you know, people will come to his workshops in Roscoe, New York, or later in Temecula, California, and you know, he would say, "Well, there's this, you know, there might as well be a giant vacuum cleaner that just sucks the awareness out of your mind as you go through the door out to the, you know, the rest of the world, you know, and break for lunch, or you know, leave the area after the seminar, the academy class, or whatever, And I think that's a great metaphor. Just imagine this vacuum just sucking it out. Well, but it's purposive. Again, it's because we resist this so much, and we need to be really patient and gentle with ourselves and everyone, because we're all doing, you know, that game together of just slowly but surely allowing this back in, because we're not ready for a peace that doesn't change, which is, it sounds insane to put it that way, but that's, we're not ready for that kind of love, that kind of non-changing, non-dual awareness that we think that we abandon because, you know, we're still afraid of love, as the Course says. So I'll go on.
I think that too. I was thinking about when you were saying that, how easy it is to be at a workshop and seminar, and you're getting it, and then the lunchtime comes and you go out and you start, you know, complaining about the president or arguing I mean, it's like, what did you just, where were you? You know, just what happened, you know? In this room, you were saying, yes, none of this is real. And the minute you step out, everything is real again. And so that we go back and forth like that. No wonder we're so confused and have so many psychotic situations going on, because you can't, you can only think with one mind. Yeah. You know, you can't have both.
Go ahead.
And it is a choice. So yeah. When I go out, start talking about me, you know, my sickness or the world or politics or something, I've chosen right then, boom, you know, I'm in order to get along with other people, or in order, you know, I have some excuse that, you know, I don't want to seem like I'm, you know, trying to be special or whatever, but it's really a bunch of bull, because really what it is, I don't want to get stuck believing this stuff. Now, then I can't complain about the world. I can't complain about my health, and I can't complain about anything, you know, and ego wants so much to be a victim. So it's that desire for victimization and that identification with that victim character that keeps me coming back to the world is real. And, you know, it's a choice every single time. So I'll shut up and let you read the next paragraph.
Okay. And it is a choice. And that's the choice that we're learning to make, and be gentle with ourselves. But as you're saying that, what came to mind is lyrics of a song by a folk singer named Christine Lavant, who I got to hear in concert in Davis, California, a number of years ago. And the lyrics were, "What was I thinking?" So I think if we can just kind of, you know, develop a very almost a humorous attitude toward our resistance. And, you know, like, not a derisive kind of thing, but just a very gentle, like, oh, yeah, there it was. I was afraid of love again. And just gently, you know, laugh it away. Not necessarily out loud, certainly when it comes to other people, but just recognize, wow, we're all so afraid of this awareness. Needlessly. Okay. So Gary continues, "While I waited for my teachers to show up, I had no shortage of happenings to occupy my time. I had just published a book based on our last conversations, Love Has Forgotten No One. One of the more surprising developments was the growing interest in Asia in the course. Suddenly, my wife, Cindy, who had become a fine teacher in her own right, as well as her sister, I might add, Jackie Laura Jones, and I were being invited to teach in Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and most surprisingly, mainland China. In fact, a teaching organization in China had invited us to come for 2-week tours twice a year for 5 years. It was a very exciting prospect to be able to go to a faraway land and see the course, which was new there, finding its way into the minds of the people of the Far East. Chowlin Kaban, the woman who had translated A Course in Miracles into the traditional Chinese they speak in Taiwan, had also translated it into the simplified Chinese they speak on the mainland. But it took years of tireless effort on her part to get the course published on the mainland. Now, I'm gonna have a quick aside here, because I've been working on the new version of ACIM.org, the Foundation for Inner Peace website. I've spent quite a number of hours poring over the pages of the translators and discovered there were actually, in addition to on the current live site, there's a number of other videos of the couple of dozen translators, most of whom were interviewed, not only reading the course's introduction in their own native tongue, which is, you know, perfect for people who need an introduction, of course, in that language. And that's currently on the FIP, Foundation for Inner Peace website, which is acim.org. But also on the new site that we put together, we'll also have other interviews of them talking about their experiences with the course. So I'm just putting sort of like a little advanced plug in for that, because if people aren't familiar with the translator interviews and their personal essays of how they came to the course, they're fascinating. And Chowlin's is no exception. But there's a couple of dozen plus on the current website, and there will be even more related material about how they got into the course and what it's meant to them on the new site, in terms of, in the form of short video conversations or monologues, actually. And so anyway, you know, you can look forward to that. But meanwhile, if you haven't seen the translator interviews on acim.org, I highly recommend, you know, spending the time to look through those. And they're just, I think, really fascinating. And it kind of reminds us that this really is a universal curriculum and has nothing to do with the specific culture, but we can integrate into the culture that we're in. And so I think it's wonderful that Gary's had the opportunity to take this to China, among a lot of other places on the planet. So okay. Chowlin had also translated – oh, let me back up. Oh, I've missed the censor. The Communist Party had to be sure that the course was not subversive to their authority. Well, it's a much bigger a challenge to the ego authority. So the particular party is just a cakewalk compared to the ego authority that's really being challenged here, right? Yeah, and whether it's a party in this country or any other country, but the whole idea of a party is that it's a part or a partial representation of the truth, and I think that's the challenge is to ego. Any pure non-dual thought system is ultimately going to, not challenge on the level of form, but challenge on the level of mind. The idea that separation and duality and partisan thinking, if you will, of what's in it for me at the expense of someone else is ultimately not workable. So it's really the ultimate form of true communism, if you want to think of it that way, or true capitalism, where if everyone's all the same, then either one of those systems, there's really no need for it ultimately. That I guess you could say. So, but anyway, but that's kind of transcends the scope of this conversation. But
it is interesting that there is a desire that the idea of communism and the idea of socialism and the idea of so many of these systems has to do with equality. But it's impossible for equality in the world because
exactly.
The ego will not allow that to happen. And I was having a conversation with someone yesterday who was saying, the course community doesn't like this, and the course community is this, and the course. And I said, actually, there is no such thing as a course community. it is impossible to have a course community. You might have a community of people that you think, study a course and you all agree, but the minute that you don't agree, that community is broken. And I said, there's a lot of communities. There's the Endeavor Academy. There's David Hoffmeister. There's, the CMC. There's so many, quote unquote, communities, but you're not going to find a community where everyone agrees on what A Course in Miracles is because there is no such thing. There is only the mind, and the mind itself is at odds with itself. So, the idea that we can all get together and agree is impossible. Egos will never agree.
Which is why I like the that wonderful skit in Life of Brian, the Monty Python film, where they say, "Oh, you're part of the Judean People's Front." No, we're the People's Front of Judea. It's like, well, sort of like I prefer that we don't get into the turf war over the different versions of the course based on the earlier drafts and all that kind of stuff. But it's, that's that whole nonsense of thinking taking form and trying to elevate it, to the level of content in the mind. And that's the mistake that we all make. And that's where if you haven't seen it, there's a movie I saw several months ago called The Circle. That's, I think, a great example of level confusion of here are these wonderful egalitarian ideals that are tried to be, brute force applied on the level of form, and it just backfires because, the free will of the participants isn't considered, as well as, just the fact that we all have seemingly different paths back to the oneness that we never left, but we have to honor those preferences, while at the same time recognizing with a little inner grin that all of those preferences really are gone in the wash, so to speak, when we truly apply what we're talking about here and what countless other mystics have been saying for millennia, and even modern physics now, and certainly, of course, miracles, that, you know, separation is just a crazy, insane notion that has a shelf life, and we're kind of in the process of you know, getting the vestiges of that craziness out of our minds by using this curriculum, and this is an accelerated curriculum for doing that. So let me finish that paragraph here. Okay. Okay. Chaolin Kaban, the woman who translated A Course in Miracles into the traditional Chinese they speak in Taiwan, had also translated into the simplified Chinese they speak on the mainland. But it took years of tireless effort on her part to get the course published on the mainland. Well, I can imagine. Yeah. So anyway, both of those books, the simplified and the traditional version of A Course in Miracles, are available on the FIP, ACIM.org website. So if you're interested or know someone who speaks either of those, you know, or speaks and or reads either of those versions, along with over two dozen other languages that's being translated. Yeah, the newest one, which isn't on the website yet, is Estonian, but it's amazing how it keeps propagating. And another quick aside is, you know, the expense involved in doing those translations is enormous, as you might imagine, because it's not something that's just in all these almost all these translator stories say, if you've read them, yeah, I thought I could do this in a year or two. Well, you know, 10 years later or 8 years later, you know, having gone through not just a cursory translation, it's like, well, okay, well, that, you know, sort of the letter, but not the spirit of the law, so to speak. But, you know, these translators, almost all of them have worked intensively with Whitson and FIP, as well as Ken Wapnick, to make sure that the consistency and the content, not just the form of the translation, is true to the spirit and the meaning behind the words. And so that's why it's taken these translations so much time and the involvement and the expenses there. So just as a plug, I think Foundation for Inner Peace and Foundation for A Course in Miracles, very much both those organizations really deserve every course student's support. You know, those who can afford any kind of discretionary philanthropy. Anyway, so those are ACIM.org and FACIM.org, respectively. One more quick aside. There is one more streaming class that the Foundation for A Course in Miracles is doing in January, and I think there's still a few more days to register for that. I've registered for that one as well as the last few, and I've attended online these virtual streaming classes, probably about a dozen of them now in the last couple of years, and they're just brilliant. And they'll resurface in some form, but for now this will be the last one. So if you haven't had the experience of hearing Jeff Siebert and Rosemary Lasasso give a day-long workshop, they're just brilliant. It's like $40, and it's so worth it. Anyway, just a quick plug for those classes as well. And there's just one left in the series that they're doing for the time being, and who knows where and how it'll resurface, but I hope it does soon. So anyway, I'll finish this paragraph, and then we can go on. Okay, Chaolin had also translated The Disappearance of the Universe into both forms of Chinese, and once the course was approved for the mainland, it didn't take long for DU, Disappearance of the Universe, as it is popularly known, to be available there as well. The timing for me was perfect. Aside from Chaolin herself, who is Chinese-American, I got to be the first well-known American teacher of the course there. So, anyway, so much for that paragraph and all the asides. I'm sure you have plenty to say, Lynn.
I do, absolutely, and I'm not going to say it all, but what I am going to say is that the idea with the translations, why it's so difficult, is because the way that A Course in Miracles is written in English has so many meanings that are it has to do with the actual words that are used. And so, Jesus is very clever. Or Helen, who actually was the one who put the words to the course, very clever in like these double entendres and puns. There's a lot of meaning in these words that are not just the meaning of the words. So if you have a translation that is just word for word from English to Chinese, then you're going to have, or Mandarin or whatever, you're going to have a lot of variation because the words do not translate literally one-on-one. And you can tell that if you, you know, I have, you know, friends who are, you know, Greek and other nationalities, and they post things in their language. And if you go translate those, you find that there's a lot of stuff that has, that really is just gibberish, because the meaning of the word has more of a nuance than is what is capable of available in like a Google Translate or something like that. So the person really has to know and understand the metaphysics of a course, and also be aware of how to communicate that. It is not a simple process. So I'm grateful for the folks that are doing it and opening up, you know, like China and other countries, Estonia, you could say. That's, you know, I guess maybe there was a translator that was available that spoke that language. You know, there's a lot that has to go into making that happen. So
there's also Arabic supplements, again, that are they're available but not, you know, publicized very much yet. So the main course itself hasn't been translated, but there was a special philanthropic donation that provided for the Song of Prayer and the Psychotherapy pamphlet to be translated into Arabic. So for those are available in advance of the course itself for any people in the Arabic world.
Well, that's pretty cool. And you know what? The Song of Prayer and the Psychotherapy pamphlet, that's the whole course. You know?
It really does have a lot of, you know, it's a tremendous distillation, isn't it? Oh, one more little plug aside. I think until tomorrow, you can go to the shop site. You can get also the entire course, including the supplements, on an MP3 thumb drive. They have a special sale that I forget exactly. I think it's $40. Anyway, but you can get the whole course on a thumb drive if you want to kind of keep it on a keychain or in your purse or day pack or whatever. You can have a whole course for your, you know, laptop, whatever, or desktop machine on a thumb drive. And that's available now on the shop site, which is shop.acim.org. You can find it there.
Very cool. All right. Yeah, well, yeah. Why don't I get one of those, because I don't have the actual I post the lessons every day on the disappearance of the universe, and I don't have the actual FIP version. I can access online. David Hoffmeister has it online. A lot of other people have it online, but they're not the literal, you know, with all the numbering and all. And I really like the FIP version for that. So,
yeah. So you have, I think, until tomorrow night to take advantage of the sale on that if you're interested.
All right. Well, I will do that today. Do it today. All right.
Okay. Enough aside.
This is the next paragraph. For those of you who just came in, we are reading from Gary Renard's newest book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And it is quite fascinating. You know, you may have, you know, I have resistance. You know, like, wow, you know, this is kind of, you know, and I noticed on the Disappearance of the Universe site, you know, people are writing in their little exceptions. Well, you know, what about this? And you know, Plato was at this time, and, you know, history, you know, doesn't agree with Artin and Persa. And it makes me laugh because history doesn't agree with truth. History doesn't agree with reality. Time frames are literally, they're just imaginary. And so, you know, what we perceive, you know, as history in this world, you know, it's just like the question of, you know, was there really historically a historical Jesus? Was there really a man who was born in Bethlehem and did all the things that it says in the Bible that he did? And then, of course, you have all these other gospels and these other stories where he went to India and he became a Buddhist monk. And, you know, you have all these stories that people tell. And, you know, the reality of it is, no, it never happened. That's the point. There is no world.
I think it's again, it's a level of confusion thing. But on the level of, to where we believe the dream, you know, if it helps people to believe in the factual personage, which I think it does for a lot of people, it does for me, and I think that's why the first half of this book is very helpful, because it helps me, who, you know, as a person who believes he's a person most of the time because of my resistance, and which I'm learning to overcome, you know, gently, patiently, and in the cosmic sense, probably very rapidly relative to however many lifetimes it would take to do this, you know, just randomly stumbling around and coming across the thought. I think this is really an accelerated curriculum for that. And so, but we still need to be patient with ourselves, because this is in the most wonderful sense of the word, a truly radical teaching that, you know, suggests that space, time, individuality, and certainly the thought system of sin, guilt, and fear is crazy, insane, and laughably bogus. You know, that's not your everyday ask the guy on the street corner kind of, you know, thinking, right? I mean, so we need to give ourselves some slack and be patient with ourselves, right?
Exactly. And there's no need to hold yourself hostage because you don't understand what's being said. You can just let it go and just know that. And just ask for ask for help in overcoming your resistance,
mm-hmm.
because only resistance that keeps us from knowing the truth. And so, you know, you may call it something else. You may call it, I'm afraid, or I'm worried, or, you know, what would happen if all of a sudden I, you know, was no longer a human body walking in the earth. My children would starve because I wouldn't go to work, or, you know, you think all these thoughts because you don't really understand what the illusion is or what you really are. And so you think that there's a lot of conditions that that are to our existence. But there is no condition to our existence. And all of these things that we make up are these just little blockades and excuses for not seeing the truth. And as the last unanswered question asks us, do I want to see the truth? Do I want to see what I denied because it was the truth? And, you know, if you can honestly answer that question and not be afraid of what you're going to see, not be afraid that you're going to disappear, not be afraid that your children are no longer going to recognize you, not be afraid that your cat won't, you know, want to be petted. You know, and these are things that literally fears that come up in the mind, and we get this kind of sense of nostalgia or grief. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen when I'm no longer relating to these, you know, wonderful people? It's a story you're making up that has nothing to do with the reality of what you are, because literally nothing happens. You know, your children don't notice because they don't actually exist. Your cat doesn't notice because your cat is in your mind. So, or my cat is in my mind. So I can't tell you where yours is. But, if you keep bringing it back to the mind and being conscious of the decisions that you're making that are making the world seem real, then you begin to see how you're making it all up. Or that's what I've been noticing anyway, very, very clearly. Okay, so we're continuing on reading. This is talking about China and Gary's experiences there. So the mainland had been changing rapidly for years. The Communist Party had allowed capitalism to become the norm, hoping to fend off social discontent. I had heard and read that going to Shanghai now was like going to Tokyo. But there was one thing you couldn't do there. You could not criticize or question the authority of the party. That could be fatal. In fact, the slaughter of students by the army in Tiananmen Square in 1989 was never mentioned on the mainland, although there were brave Chinese students studying abroad who openly spoke of it in an attempt to keep the facts about it alive. I'm just going to go to the next paragraph. people in China were forbidden to get on most of the internet sites like Google, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube were not permitted, but that didn't stop many of the people from getting what they wanted. They could get software that would trick the Chinese censors and make it look like their computers were accessing the site from another country. Indeed, much of the exposure to the course and my work has happened because of this, and the people, especially Buddhists and psychotherapists, were excited about this new teaching and its deep take on ancient wisdom. That's absolutely, I mean, look where the ancient wisdom of China, Taoism, Buddhism, they know and were put in a position where they couldn't talk about it or demonstrate it because of the restrictions of the government. And yet that didn't change the knowing of the people of the truth. So, you know, they could still access it. And we do have, you know, we have a couple of people who come in here that are in China and have some difficulty with their connections, but they still come here occasionally and listen to Course in Miracles into Pal Talk, into ACIM Gather on Pal Talk, I should say, so that people, so you're not confused when they don't come here. They come to ACIM Gather on Pal Talk if they can get in. So I know that they're trying. All right. Did you mute your mic?
Yes, I did. Thank you. Okay. I'll continue then. Another thing you couldn't do on the mainland was talk in a supportive way about the Dalai Lama. Even though he had no army, the party still feared his influence and his potentially taking back Tibet. That hardly seemed in the cards, despite the wishes of many in the West, but it made no difference. In any case, the exotic intrigue that had developed in China made me happy to be able to go there and see the Course and the Holy Spirit work their miracles of forgiveness. I'll go ahead and read another one. Another surprising development in my life since I'd last seen my teachers was that I fell in love with a little kitty. I had always been a dog person. I had the same dog for 15 years. I loved the enthusiasm of dogs, and I found cats to be a bit aloof. But Cindy had seen an adorable 3-month-old little kitty online who had no home, and I found myself, along with her, off to the rescue. Luna, as we named her, turned out to be a total joy. She was like an unbelievably cute flying monkey. She was lightning fast and entertaining, but she could also have an attitude of royalty. Having now had both a dog and a cat, I understand the difference in how they think. And I'm going to read the next two paragraphs because I think they're really fun and short. This is how a dog thinks. Wow, these people are great. They love me. They feed me. They take care of me. They give me everything. They must be gods. This is how a cat thinks. Wow, these people are great. They love me. They feed me. They take care of me. They give me everything. I must be a god. I love that little joke.
That's absolutely true. I know my cat.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, we have two cats here, so we can relate. Yeah. And they are adorable. And they think they're gods. Anyway, but it's fun.
And well, they are. Our cats are our gods.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
They do rule the roost here at my house. That's for sure. Yeah. I never had cats. Now we have 5. So, you know, it's just the way it is.
I think one of ours, Sophie, heard the word cat and or maybe telepathically, and so she's. Letting her presence be known if you can hear her in the background.
You're talking about me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's hilarious. Let's see. Where are we at now?
I think it's during the summer.
Luna is such a cute little kitty, and it makes me really happy to see. I mean, a lot of us are becoming cat people. I was never a cat person. I was allergic to them terribly, but not anymore. So there we go.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm going to go on and I'll read maybe the next couple of paragraphs, because it looks like some good stuff coming up. during the summer, Cindy and I led a retreat in Hawaii, as we did almost every year. Walking back to our room one night, we had one of our most unusual experiences ever. We looked up and noticed two half-circular objects in between the clouds. It was like they were two halves of the same whole, yet separate from each other. They were not very high up at all, maybe 1,000 feet. There were lights going through each one, and it was as if they were signaling us with the light. I got the distinct impression that they were communicating with us, speaking a language I did not understand. They weren't the slightest bit fearful. I knew intuitively that this was a spacecraft from light years away. And light years is not a a distance, by the way. I wondered if they were Pleiadians, like the ones I had met when Artin and Persa took me for a trip around the universe. It was as though they were acknowledging us, saying hello. The episode lasted only about a minute, but it was so clear and so close that it filled us with a sense of wonder. The spacecraft disappeared instantly, as if it had never been there. But I knew that even though we couldn't understand what they were saying, we had been spoken to by alien beings in a positive way. I was willing to leave it for the right time to have the exact meaning revealed to me. So, you know, it's interesting because people do see these. And, you know, I think it's just the same as any other thing appearing to us. You know, we see it because we need it. We need to see something and we need to know something. And obviously, you know, it doesn't happen to everybody because not everybody is either open. I don't think that these are beings coming from another, you know, galaxy or light years away, because there is no such thing. There is no world. So what it is a concept in my mind about other beings. And just like, you know, you might listen to, you know, Bashar or Abraham, or, you know, there are all these people that channel, you know, these characters from other universes and galaxies and whatever the heck. But, you know, the reality of it is that doesn't even exist either. You know, either the world is real or it's not. And so coming to the confusion of, you know, of all of this, really the only thing you can do is ask the question, what is it for? And if you're open to know what it's for, then you'll see the trick without the illusion. You'll know the truth without the illusion. But for the most of us who believe in a physical body and a world and space and time, it is very difficult to see the truth. And so, you know, we are shown these things through visual cues, whatever. But the reality of it is, there is no other place, there is no other time. The only thing that is here is now, and that's it. So, you know, we can, and I've seen spaceships, I've seen aliens, I've seen, you know, all this kind of stuff too. And, you know, I have to ask the question, why did I need to see those things? you know, at the time they were there for a reason. And to, you know, I was taken, Jesus actually took me when I was like 17 years old, took me to a place that was like a space station where you could just stand and see all the beings of all the worlds going in and out of their world. And, you know, at the time I thought, wow, you know, that's, you know, I've been really privileged to see this. But then at the time, I needed to see that to recognize my own thinking. So it all happens for a reason. Nobody's special because they see it. Nobody's not special because they don't. Because, again, there is no world. If you keep going back to that, then you just have to ask the question, what is it for? So I'll shut up and let you take me.
Okay. Before you go on, I just wanted to comment on that, because I think the what is it for is a perfect question to ask about anything, you know, the why we do anything. And it really resolves down to, if we're really honest with ourselves, one of two thought systems. We're either doing something to basically play into ego's propaganda of belief in separation and differences and the we they paradigm, which is all about fragmentation and duality, or it's for bringing about the undoing of that in our minds, and that would be to the Holy Spirit's curriculum. And so really everything can be either, you know, resolved into those two thought systems, either love or fear. And applying it specifically to the paranormal, in particular UFOs, I have a very specific example that I personally can't say that I've seen anything analogous to a UFO or extraterrestrial sighting of any kind. However, my mom, when she was a teenager, on Catalina Island, my mom's grandmother had a beach house there, and she would spend a good part of the summer there from time to time. And one summer on the beach on Catalina Island, she said, I think she was like 17 or something like that, she said she and a whole bunch of people watched a fleet of craft moving extremely high speed, making an abrupt right angle turn and then disappearing. So and a conventional aircraft would have, you know, torn that fleet apart, making a right angle turn, you know, just instantaneously, basically, and then disappearing. Usually not something that you experience. But my mom said if she was hallucinating, it was a mass hallucination, because she said every head on the beach out of her peripheral vision was tracking that, and everybody kind of looked at each other like, what the heck was that? And I think, again, it's probably not unlike the people in the Caribbean who saw Christopher Columbus's ships, you know, the cognitive dissonance, you know, that wasn't in their realm of experience, so they just dismissed it, you know. The Pinta, the Nina, and the Santa Maria were basically UFOs to them. And I think, for the most part, a lot of the ideas in A Course in Miracles are still like UFOs to us. I mean, that's why we have this enormous resistance, and we kind of get it intellectually, and then, you know, the vacuum cleaner over the Temecula workshop sucks the awareness out of the door, as Ken said, or we have these, you know, moments of lucidity, and then we go back to the resistance. And it's a gradual process, I think, of letting go of the resistance. So in my particular case, I'm extremely grateful that my mom had that experience, because not so much right away as a teenager, but years later, after most of her child rearing was done, and she was kind of through with the, you know, the typical American housewife kind of scenario for the most part. I remember when I was a teenager, she would drag the whole family around all these different churches in the Livermore Valley, you know, Northern California, trying to find something that worked for her. During this time, she was amassing this enormous metaphysical library. And among the many books that appeared in our home in Northern California in the mid-70s was three blue volumes called A Course in Miracles. And I remember seeing those and kind of flipping through them, but I never really did any serious study of them until about a decade later in the early 80s. And it's like, oh, wow, this is pretty interesting. I moved to Northern California and started reading them in earnest. And that was my first, you know, serious involvement with the Course back in, you know, the 83, 84 time frame. So I'm very grateful that she had this cognitive dissonance experience with some extraterrestrial craft, because it really kind of planted the seed for, you know, there's got to be more here. And that was just her story. So, but, you know, I think we all can point to things that, if we look back, were pivotal for our discovering that there was something more than meets the eye here. So, and that was just the mechanism for, you know, gave form to that desire in my mind, as it were, for that to happen. So I'm grateful for all of that. Yeah. So,
You know, I have some experiences as well. You know, I was talking about that. I had a lot of experiences with Jesus, which I was not a Christian, but I had a lot of experiences with Jesus in my late teens. And he did ask me, he showed me a whole, actually I was up meditating in the mountains up above Fort Collins and looking out over the whole panorama of, you know, Fort Collins and that whole area. And I saw it all involved in flames. I saw like it had been bombed and there were just, you know, and I could see horrific things happening. And, you know, the sky was just red glowing with all this terrible thing, like some war thing had happened. And Jesus was there and he asked me, are you willing to help me save the world? And at the time, I said, yeah, but I don't really know what to do. And, I didn't think, oh, you know, will you tell me? But I remember that because when I read it in A Course in Miracles that Jesus says to us, are you willing to help me save the world? I was like, oh my God.
same words, different context.
Yeah, amazing. All right, so you want to go on and read the next paragraph?
Sure. And this one has, again, more personal significance because I've been having conversations with this next person for several months now on a twice monthly basis, Jackie Laura Jones. Gary continues, Cindy and I would often get together with her sister Jackie and Jackie's husband Mark. We'd engage in far-out metaphysical conversations about spirituality, aliens, sound healing, conspiracy theories, and the hidden forces that run the world. The conversations were normal to us, yet I remember thinking that if anyone overheard us, they'd say, what the hell are they talking about? Of course, that was also true when the four of us simply talked about the Course. To the uninitiated, our words would seem ultra-radical, but to the advanced student, completely acceptable. And just as a quick aside, if I'll also on ACIMblog.com, and I'm sort of backlogged there, too, in terms of posting the links. But you can also go to Jackie Laura Jones' website. I think she's got a new URL. I'll find it and put it in the chat. Anyway, but she has a weekly program on the Course on Blog Talk Radio that's excellent. And she's a wonderful course teacher, as is her sister, Cindy Laura Renard. But I've been having a whole lot of fun with Jackie and twice a month talking about the Course. And she's really gets it and conveys it in a really straightforward and fun way. So, do you want to read the next paragraph?
All right. Yeah, I will. Okay. One day, I was sipping my morning coffee and thinking of the past. There was a time when I used to drink 6 cups of coffee a day and smoke 30 cigarettes. Wow, I thought. Aside from everything else, it takes time to do that. Now I had 1 cup of coffee a day and no cigarettes, but I still didn't have enough time to do the things I wanted to do. Strange illusion, I thought. Then suddenly and without ceremony, my teachers were there sitting on our black leather couch. So he was in a place just sitting, chilling, drinking his coffee, and they appeared again to him. And do you want me to go ahead and read the conversation?
Sure. Why don't you read a few of the dialogue?
Okay. Arton. Hey, bro, you've had a busy year. Congrats on the new book being out. Gary. Thanks, but I should congratulate you. After all, the best parts of it come from you guys. Arton, oh, I don't know. As one of our readers wrote to you, you're not our water boy anymore. Gary, and how are you, my unattainable beauty? Talking to Persa, of course. Persa, still unattainable. So let's get down to business, shall we? Gary, you sound serious. Is something urgent? Persa. Not really, but we want to emphasize to you that the reason we keep visiting you is to help people keep the process going of undoing their egos and accelerating that process. The undoing of the ego takes time, and it's easy for people to get distracted in many different ways. We'll point out some of those ways as we go along. Arton, and don't forget that it takes a combination of repetition and the introduction of new ideas. You'll be hearing both. So tell me, how are you doing forgiving your critics? And, of course, we all know that Gary has a lot of critics. Gary, pretty good. Besides, you know what they say about critics. Arson, no, Gary, what do they say about critics? scary. Critics are like eunuchs in a harem. They see it performed every night, but they can't do it themselves. Oh, my God. First off, that's not exactly what Artin meant by forgiving, but I appreciate the humor. And then Gary says, you know, Cindy and I had lunch once in Wilshire with this guy named John, who she graduated with from the University of Santa Monica. The conversation turns his back that there are a lot of angry, negative people out there on the Internet, and he said something that really struck me. He said, Gary, you've got two kinds of people. You've got your people and not your people. Why waste your time and energy responding to or thinking about the ones who are not your people? Don't bother. They're not going to change their minds anyway, not until they're ready to. What you want to do is spend your time and energy on the ones who are your people. Then your efforts will always be well spent. That made a lot of practical sense to me. And yes, forgiveness is even deeper. So I'm going to stop right there. And it's true. Why waste your time and your breath trying to communicate to someone who's not interested in what you're talking about? And all you do is annoy people, which I know very well because I tend to annoy people in that same way. so, you know, just learn, know when to hold them and know when to fold them. Know when to walk away, know when to run, you know?
actually, on a practical level, that really makes sense. On the level of the course, there's actually a saying that I've enjoyed for a number of decades, even before I got back into the course, and that was in the mid-80s, basically, when before the internet, really, there was a mimeographed sheet of all the sub-laws of Murphy's Laws that went around the office I worked in at Grass Valley Group in Northern California. And on this sheet that had the usual, you know, if anything can go wrong, it will, which is the basic law of Murphy's Law, which is really sort of a statement of ego, the ego premise that, you know, anything that's good is essentially going to go, you know, be turned to crap. But that's basically the ego's plan. That's his strategy. But anyway, one of the sub-laws that I thought was very zen, in addition to all the usual corollaries, like, you know, the odds of the bread landing butter side down or jam side down is directly proportional to the cost of the carpet and all those kind of funny ones. But there was one that was very zen that was always my favorite. And that is one that was called Garth's Distinction. And again, this is just from this photocopied list of all these sub-laws of Murphy's Law. And the Garth's distinction went, there are two types of people, those who divide people into two types and those who don't. Anyway, I always thought that was great.
I love that. And that's the truth. There are two types of people.
So on the level of form.
Don't.
Yeah, so, pardon me. So I'm just gonna say on the level of form, it kind of makes sense. Like Gary's friends was saying, you know, just spend your time on those who are receptive, and just figure that those who are, you know, completely immersed in the resistance, you know, they'll get it in their own time, as we all will. I mean, because we're all resisting in one degree or another. Otherwise, we wouldn't need this remedial curriculum, right? But, you know, work with the ones that appear to be more receptive, and I think that's what we're all doing, and we're all drawn to, you know, where we can actually be the most benefit. And so that's why, you know, when the Course says, you know, what could you not, you know, how could you not, be happy if you knew that everything, all events past, present, and to come were gently planned by one whose goal was your greatest good. I'm paraphrasing as usual, but, you know, that's really the heart of it, isn't it? If we know that everything is an opportunity for our forgiveness classroom, then we don't question or, you know, be concerned or upset by things that appear to be challenging. But we know that it's on a pragmatic level, it's probably best to find those that we can relate to. But then, you know, when we come across people that are confrontational, just, you know, do what we can to realize, okay, this is my forgiveness classroom. This is something that I need to look at. Otherwise, it wouldn't be appearing in my dream script, right? So. Shall I continue on?
So yeah, exactly. And gosh, we only have 3 minutes left, or 2 minutes left.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll read another okay. little bit. Short, a little bit. Okay. Persa, well, we're going to be going pretty deep with you during this series of visits, my brother, and we're going to be doing it in a way that we know you've been waiting for. Gary, I knew it. You've been picking up on the fact that I want to know how Jesus got to be Jesus. Of course, I'll call him Jay. And while we're at it, how did Buddha get to be Buddha? What were their dream lifetimes like the time before that? What did they learn and apply? We all know an ounce of application is worth a pound of knowledge. Persa, it sure is, and you're asking an appropriate question. When a master like Jay comes back for his final lifetime, it's not like he had a big learning curve. He already knows everything he has to know in order to be enlightened. The story of Jay teaching the rabbis in the temple when he was 12 years old is true. They even called him rabbi, which means teacher. He already knew everything. There were just a couple of big lessons that were appropriate for him to teach and learn during that lifetime, including, of course, the crucifixion. You know, we could actually just wrap it up with that and then reread from the top of the page there again next week. How's that sound?
That sounds like a great idea, because this is a huge concept.
Yeah.
That you know, once I actually, and I'm bragging, I think I got this, but once I really got this, that you know, all these things, first off, because time is not linear, that it is all a script and a dream, and that we move around between these different scenarios in the dream, learning whatever it is that we need to learn in that particular, you know, time and space. So this is really an important part. So I appreciate that very much, and so thank you, Bruce, for joining me.
Thank you, Lynn, and everyone. Always a pleasure.
All right. And I'm trying to do a Casco, which is a podcast thing that's on WordPress.
Okay.
I've been dealing with those guys. They're driving me a little nutty, but I think that there's a way that I can actually download these into their system and actually post them on my website. So.
Oh, great.
I'm working on it anyway. So, and today seems like I'm going to be successful, because I successfully changed that Amazon password at this.
Great.
All right. So, Bruce Rawls, thank you so much.
Likewise, and, it's always a joy. And we'll pick up next week. And have a great week, everyone.
All right. And also, I wanted to let folks know I'm participating in something called ACIM Live 365. And it's something with Maureen Muldoon. And I'll post a link in the room that you can go and join up with us. And every day at 6:45 a.m. Central Time, which is 5:45 my time, someone is doing the lesson with a group on a phone call. And I'm going to be doing it on Saturday morning. So I'll be 5:45 a.m. my time doing A Course in Miracles lessons with this ACIM Live 365 with Maureen Muldoon. And so I'll be awake even earlier on Saturday morning.
We'll both get up before the sun.
Exactly. All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. I love
likewise,
you, brother. And
likewise.
All the work you do. And I'll talk to you next week.
Have a great week, all.
All right. Now I'm going to turn the mic over to Devin and Barb.